The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Boot computer, list of today's guests, signing in chat room, lining up news articles, checking levels, adjusting cam, secure wire connection, restart computer, checking video feed.
With all she's got to do, you'd think Nicole Sandler was a one-woman band. Well, she is, and she's ready for another show. And now, here's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com.
And the Progressive Voices Network. Welcome to a Friday. I can't believe we made it through this week, and what a week it's been. Oh my goodness, how it's ending. You know, midway through yesterday's show, I don't know if you could tell, but I kind of lost energy. And it was getting really warm in here. Now, my studio often is warm because I've got a lot of equipment in here and no ceiling fan for a number of reasons. Anyway, what had happened was our air conditioning went out. Yes. Here in Florida, it's September 15th, so it is still technically summer. Our AC broke. We made it through the hurricane. We kept power, but, you know, a few days later, the air conditioning breaks. So the guy came out last night. The compressor is shot. We are waiting for the new unit, which hopefully will be here tomorrow. So I actually thought about canceling the show today just because it is so freaking hot in here. But I thought I've missed so many shows lately that I didn't want to do that. And I'm excited about today's guest. So you may hear the fan whirring in the background, and I apologize for that, but it is a necessary evil. I can't even imagine without the fans. It gets really warm down here, and it's not just the heat, as they say. It's the humidity as well. So bear with me. If you see me fanning myself, you'll know why. It is warm in here. All right, what was I going to talk to you about? This president we have, I got to tell you, it is so disconcerting. Last night, watching the news, and sure enough, there's news of another missile launch from North Korea. And it turns out this was a pretty big one as well. Once again, it went over Japan. Let me see if I can find my notes on it. Yeah, it was here. They say, let's see. It went further than the last one, far enough to show that if it had been pointed in a different direction, it could have hit Guam. And it made me think of this nut job who's sitting in the White House, who's more concerned right now about an anchor on ESPN. Who said he's a white supremacist. Well, you know, if the shoe fits, Donald, maybe not a white supremacist, maybe an orange supremacist. I mean, yesterday, instead of, you know, he signaled that he's going to sign that the resolution that says that condemns the hate stuff that took place after in Charlottesville, that condemns neo-Nazis and white supremacists and white nationalists and the KKK and all that, because he had to, because it passed both houses of Congress unanimously. He had no choice but to sign on to it. But then did you hear what he said on Air Force One? He was talking about meeting with Tim Scott, the senator, the only Republican African-American senator who wanted to talk to him about this. And he actually said this.
We had a great meeting. Tim Scott's been a friend of mine for a long time. I've been a supporter of his when I was a civilian. I was one of his earliest supporters.
And, when I was a civilian.
I supported him when he ran. And we had a great talk yesterday. I think especially in light of the advent of Antifa, if you look at what's going on there, you know, you have some pretty bad dudes on the other side.
The
also.
Other side, he's calling Antifa the other side.
Now, because of what's happened since then with Antifa, you look at, you know, really what's happened since Charlottesville. A lot of people are saying, in fact, a lot of people have actually written, gee, Trump might have a point.
No, they haven't.
Some very bad people on the other side also, which is true. But we had a great conversation.
So he's talking about the Antifa guys being on the other side. Now, granted, some of them use tactics that aren't necessarily peaceful. But yeah, on the other side of the white supremacists, they're on the other side. Antifa stands for anti-fascist. They're fighting the fascists, the not neo-Nazis, the KKK people. That's what they're doing. And Trump calls them the other side. So meanwhile, there's Trump mouthing off about that stuff. He just can't leave well enough alone. And so last night, Hillary Clinton was on Rachel Maddow's show. And I didn't watch the whole thing, but knowing that Kim Jong-un launched another missile, I tuned in for the beginning to hear what she would say about it. And sure enough, and you know, I'm not a big fan of Hillary Clinton's, but oh my God, she made sense.
You've said that President Trump is being played by Kim Jong-un, that Trump is somehow playing right into his hand. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean a couple things. One, we know we can't get anything done in this very threatening situation if we don't work with our allies, South Korea and Japan, and also bring China in. The president has basically insulted and attacked South Korea.
Yep.
South Korea is literally, you know, within miles of the border with North Korea.
They're on the border.
So at risk
they're
if something
right
were done by Kim Jong-un. Japan, which now has, as you said, two missiles flying over it, is going to have to be coaxed into a very intensive diplomatic effort, because the alternative for Japan is to say, we're going to defend ourselves. We're not going to sit by and let this happen. So what I've been advocating, which, you know, it's not revolutionary, but it's what we need, is intensive diplomacy and upping our missile defense systems, both in South Korea and in Japan. Now, that won't make China happy. They don't want us to put our THAAD system or other advanced missile defense into these two countries. But that should bring them to the table so that they are part of making it clear to Kim Jong-un that there are consequences. And the message has to be not hysterical, not delivered in a tweet.
Go figure.
But very clear and convincing that if you attack our allies or you go after any territory, be it Guam or any part of the United States, we will have to retaliate, and we will do so with devastating consequences. We don't want to get there. That is not the preferred position. You don't start with that. You make it clear that's where, if he does offensive measures against us, we would end up. But here's my big concern. Diplomacy with North Korea is complicated. It requires people who know the language,
yep,
the customs,
yep,
the history. We have decimated our State Department. Foreign Service officers with decades of experience have either been ignored or in some cases pushed so hard that they have resigned. Right now, we need the best people we can possibly muster to have a full court press on diplomacy. And then
diplomacy,
we can see realistically
what a concept
where we are. But this missile test is sending a message from Kim Jong-un that he is not deterred. And that's what I mean about all the tough talk that we hear from our president really actually playing right into Kim Jong-un's hands. And that's what I mean when I say he's been played. And this is a clear and present danger. And if it's allowed to go forward, we will face even worse choices. That's why right now we need smart diplomatic intervention. If we don't have it in the government, then bring in some people from the outside with experience. We have experienced diplomats who have dealt with North Korea. But this needs to be happening right now. And get over the Twitter stuff and get on to the diplomatic negotiations.
You know, look, again, no fan of Hillary Clinton here, but listening to her in conjunction with what we hear from Donald Trump, it's sanity. She's talking about diplomacy, a word that I don't think Trump knows the meaning of. I'm having a hard time getting the words out, but what a saner place we would be in right now if she were in the White House and not him. Instead, we have the orange guy who's tweeting about ESPN and his Muslim ban. and terrorism in the UK before he knew what was going on. Get the hell off the Twitter, Donald. Oh, this whole thing is just making me sick. All right. Well, we'll take a break. We're going to talk about the actual bigger threat to we here in the United States, and that's domestic terrorism, with our guest today, Jeannie Devon, who is the author of the book, the co-author of the book, The Blood of Patriots. So you'll hear all about it. But first, what's news?
I read the news today. Oh boy.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Police in London are conducting a manhunt for a suspect who planted a bucket bomb on the packed District Line tube during rush hour Friday morning. No arrests have been made. At least 22 people were taken to local hospitals with injuries. Mayor Sadiq Khan condemned the attack and the, quote, hideous individuals who attempt to use terror to harm us and destroy our way of life. As London has proven again and again, we will never be intimidated or defeated by terrorism. President Donald Trump responded to the attack by taking to Twitter and calling the terrorists losers and using the attack to promote his travel ban against people from six Muslim-majority nations. While on Air Force One en route back to Washington, D.C. after a trip to visit hurricane-stricken Naples, Florida Thursday afternoon, the president once again stood by his original claim that both sides were to blame for violence in Charlottesville, Virginia last month between white supremacists and counter-protesters. He was telling reporters about his meeting with Senator Tim Scott at the White House the day before.
We had a great meeting. Tim Scott's been a friend of mine for a long time. I've been a supporter of his when I was a civilian. I was one of his earliest supporters, and I supported him when he ran. And we had a great talk yesterday. I think especially in light of the advent of Antifa, if you look at what's going on there, you know, you have some pretty bad dudes on the other side also. And essentially, that's what I said. Now, because of what's happened since then with Antifa, you look at, you know, really what's happened since Charlottesville. A lot of people are saying, in fact, a lot of people have actually written, gee, Trump might have a point. I said, you got some very bad people on the other side also, which is true. But we had a great conversation.
The New York Times' Maggie Haberman was on CNN's New Day discussing the incident.
I was really struck by the senator's statement yesterday in particular about that, you know, this is who he is, because that, I think, is what most people come away with from hearing the president talk. This is who he is, and this is the way he sees things. We know that he instinctively tends to do what about that side when any issue comes up, and he's not wrong that violence caused by Antifa is problematic. The issue is that it ends up sounding like he's saying all violence is equal, and it negates the questions about racism, which is what this is about in the first place. It's not just about whether people are violent. It is about certain attitudes and beliefs about race that are propelling violence on one side. And while the tactics used by Antifa can be discussed, the basic idea is that a lot of people who were at those protests, where it was a counter-protest to things that had sprung up in the first place in Charlottesville, but he thinks he's right on this. And as we've seen many times, when he gets an idea in his head, it is hard to get him off of it, even if he has said something that sounds sort of, you know, reassuring or like what he is supposed to be saying previously.
Haberman also spoke about her story detailing Trump's anger with Attorney General Jeff Sessions when it was learned that Robert Mueller had been named special counsel. The president attributed the appointment of Mueller to Sessions' decision to recuse himself from the Russia investigation, accusing Sessions of disloyalty. Trump told Sessions that choosing him to be attorney general was one of the worst decisions he had made, and he called him an idiot.
And the fact that the president saw this through the prism of something very specific, which was disloyalty, that was the word he used. I think people have gotten focused on the word idiot, which is obviously very demeaning, but the president just saw this as a personal act of disloyalty to him, as opposed to a public official and somebody who is supposed to be a guardian of the public trust doing their job.
Haberman and Michael Schmidt report that Mr. Sessions told the president he would quit and sent a resignation letter to the White House, according to four people who were told details of the meeting. Sessions would later tell associates that the demeaning way the president addressed him was the most humiliating experience in decades of public life. Trump ended up rejecting the resignation, though in July he once again told aides he wanted to remove Sessions, though again he took no action. North Korea conducted its longest ever test flight of a ballistic missile Friday, sending an intermediate range weapon hurtling over U.S. ally Japan into the northern Pacific Ocean in a launch that signals both defiance to its rivals and a big technological advance. Since the president threatened North Korea with fire and fury in August, Pyongyang has conducted its most powerful nuclear test, threatened to send missiles into the waters around the U.S. territory of Guam, and launched two missiles of increasing range over Japan. Hillary Clinton sat for an interview with Rachel Maddow Thursday night and said that Trump has been played by Kim Jong-un.
This missile test is sending a message from Kim Jong-un that he is not deterred. And that's what I mean about all the tough talk that we hear from our president, really actually playing right into Kim Jong-un's hands. And that's what I mean when I say he's been played. And this is a clear and present danger. And if it's allowed to go forward, we will face even worse choices. That's why right now we need smart diplomatic intervention. If we don't have it in the government, then bring in some people from the outside with experience. We have experienced diplomats who have dealt with North Korea, but this needs to be happening right now. And get over the Twitter stuff and get on to the diplomatic negotiations. I got
good news. And that's a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider a contribution as we are 100% listener funded. For more info, visit NicoleSandler.com/donate. And we turn now to our friends at the Talk Media News Service to find out what else is going on. Doug Christian, are you there?
Hello, Nicole. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. How are you?
All right. Well, are you? Have you recovered at all from the hurricane?
Made it through the hurricane, only to lose our air conditioning down here in Florida. So it's sitting in the heat right now, but hanging in there. Glad it's Friday. That's all I can say.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are. I mean, it's been kind of an exhausting week, frankly.
It really has.
And yeah, for you and in D.C., of course, and as we're speaking, I think right now, perhaps it's ended, and that is that Paul, the former campaign director for Donald Trump, Paul Manafort's spokesman, was actually called before a federal grand jury, and we don't know why, but we can only imagine that it is to turn up the heat upon Paul Manafort himself.
So, that's interesting.
I'm for sure that they're looking for a weekend too.
I'll bet.
Yeah.
So what else is happening today?
Well, of course, there's repercussions from both the terrorist attack in London, of course, and the British are not too happy with the president's tweet. They feel that it kind of the rhetoric isn't helpful.
So what did he do? He jumped the gun. He said this was something Scotland Yard was already looking at, and he called it a terrorist attack before they said anything of the sort. And do we know that Scotland Yard was looking at it? Apparently this was brought up in today's White House press briefing as well.
And there is no evidence that Scotland Yard had it on the site. None. I mean, he made that up. I mean, he was a great tabloid artist when he needed to make news in New York, but he's the president of the United States, and yet he's behaving like a reality television host who really knows how to make hay with tabloids.
Yeah, that's what he does. That's what he does. And he makes things up. And when you're talking, international diplomacy and terrorism on the world stage, that's not the time to, play fast and loose with the facts.
No, it isn't. And I mean, here's the crazy thing. And that is that he, in many ways, he's an amazing entertainer. And I'd say almost a weakness of our democracy is that somehow people who get the votes, he didn't even get the majority of votes, but he got enough votes, is that they were somehow are able to kind of spark people's interest enough that people aren't even, they're bored by policy. I just feel like, how do we get back to boring government? How do we get back to a sense of like, okay, you know, doing, making sure that things work, that our infrastructure is okay, all these things without this kind of nonsense. I don't have the answer. I just think it's an amazing question.
Yeah, it is a good question. I don't know. I wish it would happen if we could just snap our fingers and go back to November 9th and have a different outcome.
Yeah, did you hear Rachel Maddow's interview with Hillary last night?
I heard a little bit of it. I played a clip of her talking about how Trump is being played by Kim Jong-un, which he is. Any world leader will play him because this is not his arena. This is not where he belongs. And he's just in so over his head.
Oh, he is. I mean, and Andrea Mitchell years ago, or you know, said that his knowledge of foreign affairs is paper thin, and I mean, it's okay even as a reality television host, but as president of the United States, it's a little much. I mean, one of the things that I had actually proposed to first of the State Department. I thought it was a terrible idea, but I still think it's an interesting idea, is that, for instance, if you, let's say you're going to get the lowest level diplomatic position within the State Department, you need to be able to pass the Foreign Service Examination to be able to say, I know what I'm doing, to have the lowest level position. The only certification you actually need to be president is obviously you have to get the vote in the Electoral College, but you also have to be 35 years of age and what they call a natural born citizen. There is no, but you have to be a lawyer. You need to go pass the bar exam. You
nope.
want to be the director of, you know, of the United States. You don't need anything to be able to do that.
No,
and I find that just kind of odd.
It is. It became a popularity contest this year. And for whatever reason, you know, he turns my stomach, but he was more popular than she was. Well, she was a horrible candidate. We had the two worst possible candidates. And it was like, you know, which one is worse rather than which one is better?
Well, the sad thing is that, for instance, when you hear on the Rachel Maddow show, you know, when you're in person, she's an incredibly... She's funny. She's gregarious. She's all these things. Why does she block out so badly? It's a mystery to me. Because, honestly, I think she was overhandled. I feel like, and another thing I find so odd is that, for instance, during in the midst of the early part of the campaign, even as the, you know, Michael Schmidt had done had broken the email server story and all that, where it was just kind of getting rough for her before it was really rough. And that was, is that on Morning Joe, for instance, Donald Trump, he broke convention. He would call in and just chat for an hour. He got an hour of free publicity. And he did that so many times.
Well, not only that, but you know, CNN, they'd all run his rallies start to finish. They'd show the empty podium, you know, waiting for him to show up. They treated him like he was this superstar. They gave him all this free airtime. Of course, it, you know, ratcheted up the interest in him.
Oh, it was. It was so sad because, well, of course, they made so much money on that. I mean, basically, all the executives were able to prove that somehow their old news business was a good one. And of course, if you have this reality television star who knows how to gin up excitement, that's going to happen. There used to be legislation that basically said you had to, if you're going to show a certain amount of percentage of conservative news, you have to show a certain amount of liberal news. You have to, there's got to be balance. That was taken out, and
yep.
I guess this is kind of the result of that in some ways. But I feel that, you know, when Hillary just gets on her own, she is actually, you know, she's so gregarious. And Nika kept on saying, Hillary, please call us. We want to talk to you. And she was distant. That I found really astonishing because
right.
I just felt like, wait a minute, you're basically saying I'm being forced to run for president. You're not being forced. Please, mean, FDR said, I welcome my opponents. I want them. I want to debate them.
Well, right.
That kind of.
Hillary Clinton was not a warm, fuzzy person. Now, I don't think Donald Trump was either, but he knows how to play the game. He knows how to use media. She didn't. And here we are relitigating the election and why he won. It is a shame every day. It's, you know, when you look at his missteps and his I'm looking at his Twitter feed right now, and he's tweeting about ESPN, urging his followers to boycott a TV network because one of its anchors said something mean about him. This is a miscarriage of justice. It's a misuse of his power for certain. And these are the things that he's concentrating on instead of, you know, what's going on in the world.
It's astonishing. Well, I have a theory about this, and that is that I don't think he ever wanted. I don't think he ever expected to be president.
No, he didn't.
I do. My theory, and I think I've borne out with. I think a few people agree with me on this. Is that he actually was trying to renegotiate his deal with the Apprentice. That somehow they were going to be looking for other. Margaret Burnett was going to be looking for another host. And every time he has kind of published a ghost-written book, his kind of popularity within the media has gone up. And he thought, what could be better than for him to basically brand himself on a presidential campaign,
mm-hmm.
never thinking that he would actually be becoming president
right.
of the United States?
Oh, never in a million years. He didn't expect to win.
No.
Yeah, he was as surprised
as
she was.
Yeah, and that's why he never even studied any foreign policy. I mean, if you're going to, one thing that Hillary Clinton said last night was that every Secretary of State, they meet with all the Secretary of States on both sides. You know, there's no, at that point, there's no partisanship. We just want to know how to get the job done.
Mm-hmm.
And they sit down together. These are the issues. These are what we found worked. This is what didn't work to get that right. And yet, not only did Donald Trump not do that with the presidency, but from what I gather from what she said, Rex Tillerson hasn't done that at the State Department.
Yeah, Rex Tillerson. And he hasn't staffed up his State Department, so none of the undersecretaries for the different trouble spots of the world are in place. It's like a ghost town, apparently, around the State Department. And a lot of, you know, state veterans are really nervous about it.
It's a very sad situation. I mean, these are people that have trained their whole lives, many of them. They speak, they're polyglot, they speak many different languages. They've studied the issues in great detail. They're not partisan in almost every way. They're actually just trying to figure out the policy. And we get the best return for our buck with the State Department. We pay 1% of what we pay to the Pentagon for what we get from the State Department. And yet we get a lot more than that, as James Mattis said. He said, if we don't fund the State Department well, then I have to buy more bullets.
Oh, God.
And yeah, and so, I mean, we shouldn't be increasing the State Department. We should be multiplying it times 10.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, you don't negotiate with somebody you agree with. You negotiate with somebody you disagree
right.
with.
Right. And
that's
the clip that I played of Hillary Clinton from last night, you know, talking about how we need diplomacy with North Korea. And unfortunately, that's something that the Obama administration really didn't engage in for a number of reasons, but none of them good. And here we are now with the most inept administration probably ever in history running the show while we have a nuclear powered madman lobbing missiles across the ocean. It's kind of scary times.
It's scary. And here's the thing, and that is that Richard Nixon, who obviously had his own issues. I mean, here was a guy who actually knew policy. I mean, I would give anything to have Nixon back, who was as corrupt as could be, over this guy. I mean, because at least he knew about you know, basic governing.
Right.
Is all I could say.
All right.
And, yeah.
Doug Christian from the Talk Media News Service at talkmedianews.com. Doug, it was good talking with you today.
It was a pleasure, Nicole.
Thanks so much. We'll talk next week. Bye-bye.
Yeah.
All right.
Bye.
Bye. All right. Coming up in just a moment, we're going to speak with Jeannie Devon. If you remember listening to Shannon Moore on the radio or hearing her talk, you've heard from Jeannie Devon as well. She ran a website called The Mud Flats up in Alaska, and she became catapulted into our consciousness when Sarah Palin was John McCain's running mate. We're going back a few years here. Anyway, Jeannie Devon joins us next to talk about a new book that she co-authored called The Blood of Patriots, How I Took Down an Anti-Government Militia with Beer, Bounty Hunting, and Badassery. It's not her story, but she helps tell the story of a guy named Bill Fulton, and it's fascinating. And Jeannie Devon joins us next, so don't go away. I'm Nicole Sandler, NicoleSandler.com, and the Progressive Voices Network.
Besides being founders of our republic, what did Thomas Jefferson and George Washington have in common? Answer? Hemp. America's founders were strong promoters of this extraordinarily useful agricultural crop, and both Jefferson and Washington grew it. The first draft of our Constitution was written on hemp paper, and as late as World War II, the government urgently pushed farmers to grow the crop as part of a Hemp for Victory program. So why are American farmers today prohibited from producing this patriotic, profitable, and pesticide-free plant? Political nuttiness. Most recently, in a frenzy of reefer madness, U.S. drug police decided that President Nixon's Controlled Substance Act of 1970 not only outlawed marijuana, but also its non-narcotic cousin, industrial hemp. If ignorance is bliss, they must have been ecstatic, yet their nuttiness remains the law of our land. The good news is that a wave of sanity is now wafting across America. In Colorado, for example, farmer Michael Bowman and Denver hemp advocate Linda Parker helped pass Amendment 64 in last fall's election. It legalizes personal pot use, which got all the media attention, but it also directs the legislature to set up a program for, quote, the cultivation, processing, and sale of industrial hemp. Bowman now hopes to be the first American farmer in generations to plant a legal crop of it, hoping to do so on April 30th, the 80th birthday of family farmer hero and hemp champion Willie Nelson. The red state of Kentucky is also on the move. Its Republican Ag Commissioner, backed by its Chamber of Commerce, is campaigning to legalize hemp farming there. And Kentucky Senator Rand Paul is co-sponsoring a national bill with Oregon Democrat Ron Wyden to take hemp off the controlled substance list. This is Jim Hightower saying, to help spread this seed, go to votehemp.com.
If you like these feisty pops of populism that Hightower zings out on the airwaves, check out the Hightower Lowdown. Jim's monthly newsletter provides the in-depth lowdown on what the greed heads of Wall Street and the boneheads of Washington are doing to us behind the scenes. With Hightower's saucy Texas humor and truth-telling populist perspective, the lowdown literally can lift you up. And get this, you can have the lowdown delivered to your mailbox or email each month for only $15 a year. Yes, 12 issues, only 15 bucks. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Can't afford a monthly donation? Is that what's getting you down, Bunky? But maybe you shop on Amazon.com occasionally?
Well then, just use the NicoleSandler.com Amazon portal, and we'll get a small commission on all your purchases.
But I just bought...
Don't worry, we can't see what you bought.
Just bookmark Amazon through the NicoleSandler.com portal, and use it. Every purchase helps Nicole stay on the air.
In fact, I've got a book that you can buy using that Amazon portal. I'll link to it from my blog today at NicoleSandler.com, where we post the podcast each day. It's called The Blood of Patriots. We're heading up to Alaska now to talk with Jeannie Devon. She's a New York Times bestselling author, political writer, and the founding editor of The Mudflats, who catapulted to national attention when Sarah Palin was plucked from Wasilla, Alaska, to be John McCain's vice presidential pick back in the 2008 election. She's the co-author of this fascinating new book. Hey, Jeannie.
Hey, Nicole.
It's good to hear from you. And I was so excited when I heard about the book, and especially reading the nice blurbs on the back from, you got some good blurb writers on here. Tom Hartman.
Yes, I did.
Jason Leopold, Greg Pallast. I thought, okay, with recommendations like that, let me check it out. And sure enough, I got to tell you, I picked up the book on a Saturday morning, and I got probably halfway through in one sitting. In one afternoon, well, in one full day, I should say. And then we got hit by a hurricane, so I'm not quite done yet.
You're forgiven for that.
Thank you. No, I'm about three quarters of the way through, and it is enticing, and it's not the kind of thing that I would think that I would usually get pleasure out of, because it is about, you know, a lot of people with guns, but this is the Alaska mindset, isn't it?
It is, and it's really funny that you say that, because one of the things that has cropped up again and again and again are people who have contacted me and said, if I didn't already know your writing, if I didn't already read The Mudflats, if I wasn't familiar with you, I never would have bought this book,
right.
And I really would have missed out. So I think that, you know, the cover and the title and the premise may seem off-putting to a certain audience, but I think it's really... It's an important message, and I hope that it's told in a way that's engaging and entertaining and funny.
Oh, it absolutely
doesn't sound funny.
Right. No, not at all. I mean, The Blood of Patriots, the full title is The Blood of Patriots, How I Took Down an Anti-Government Militia with Beer, Bounty Hunting, and Badassery. So the second part of the title, it's like, okay, that sounds like there can be a bit of fun to it. But it's written beautifully, and I guess that's where
you
come in, because you wrote it with Bill Fulton. It's Bill Fulton's story.
Right.
How did you hook up with him?
Well, it's funny. I was reporting on a trial that was occurring up here in Anchorage in the federal court, and it had to do with a sovereign citizen. And for those not familiar, that's sort of an anti-government group that feels that literally that the law does not apply to them, that they are above the law as a sovereign, and that law enforcement and the federal government have no authority to tell them what to do. So you can imagine, right? What
right.
could go wrong?
Oh, yes.
So this militia leader up here who subscribed to that philosophy was on trial for conspiracy to commit murder, a ton of different firearms offenses. I think it was 12 or 14 different things. And I thought to myself, I have to go report on this trial. This is crazy. So I went with the thought that I was going to go for a couple days and ended up staying the duration for weeks. And it was absolutely fascinating. And
so,
I was thinking to myself, I need to write a book about this.
Right. So that was Schaefer Cox, who was on trial?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And then Bill Fulton, who had been a witness, who everybody in Anchorage had believed to be this sort of crazy right-wing extremist that owned this scary military store, turned out to be working for the FBI undercover to bust this other guy. So Anchorage, as a collective psyche, was just freaked out by this, because everybody hated him, or I shouldn't say everybody, but the centrists and people on the left really disliked this guy. And then it turned out that he was benevolent the entire time and trying to put away the really crazy people. So Bill contacted me when he was reading my reporting of the trial and said, hey, if you want an interview when this is all over, let me know.
Uh-huh.
So I thought, yes, I do want an interview. Thank you very much. And so we started talking, and he asked if I would write his book. And hundreds and hundreds of hours of conversation later, I hope I did a good job retelling his story.
You absolutely did. It is one of those. It reads like a novel. You know, I'm a big fan. I'm in Florida. I'm a big fan of Carl Hiaasen. And first of all, the name Schaefer Cox sounds like a character in a Carl Hiaasen book. it can't be real. And then I'm reading, and it's like, okay, no, this stuff really happened. So Bill Fulton, it was a veteran, and he wound up moving up to Alaska while still in the service, right? And then he got too,
yes,
his body got too injured and stuff, and he had to retire. And he opened this military surplus store called the Drop Zone. It sounds like he really had to pretend to be something that he wasn't, to be a right-wing crazy. In fact, there's a part where he talks about after the election, the 2008 election, after Obama wins, someone puts up one of those Obama as the Joker posters in his window. And he talked about a blogger who came into a store and yelled at him. And I'm thinking, maybe that's how they met. I thought that must have been you.
No, that was a different blogger. I've had a lot of people ask me that. So, but that was not me. But yeah, I think he sort of went along because part of keeping his business afloat at that point, and this is a theme that comes up in the book a lot, is that he employed a lot of fellow vets that had served in the Middle East and other conflicts and were really having a difficult time bouncing back and forth between military service overseas and civilian life. And so part of the purpose of the drop zone was a gathering place, a place where people could talk, could heal, could gather, and do something useful.
Right.
And so these guys that were having these terrible problems reintegrating into a world that had become sort of alien to them over the many years and deployments were really depending on him. And he kind of took this mother hen role. And so if most of the people that shopped in his store didn't agree with him politically, he was sort of agnostic about that. He kind of went along and said, well, I've got to keep open and I've got to keep successful. And the more successful I am, the more of these guys I can hire. And that was really his motivation, I guess.
Right. I guess, you know, when you're in the military, you have to be stoic about many things. And it sounds
right.
Like he walked that line very, very tenderly, or gingerly might be the better word. But for instance, putting the Obama picture up in his window, you know, he didn't put it there. Someone else did. And he's like, well, you know, I'll leave it there. And he even took the drubbing that came with it.
Right.
So as not to offend most of the people who were his clientele.
And in addition to that, if you can imagine, I think I used the analogy of bear baiting in the book. It's like he had a good relationship with the military, with CID and internal affairs, and he would oftentimes run into some nefarious characters who were actually currently involved with the military. And he would call CID and be like, hey, this guy's coming in here and he's trying to sell a pallet of, you know, clips,
right,
of 30-round clips. And, you know, and they'd say, oh, yeah, these are probably stolen. And so he had this back channel with law enforcement in the military and found that the crazier his store was, the more these people would come around. So it was almost, in a way, like bait.
Right.
If that makes any sense.
Right. And that's sort of how he got involved with the FBI. He wasn't he wasn't paid by the FBI, was he? It sounded
no.
like he just like did this because he saw something bad. He wound up, well, what happened? Why did he originally contact the FBI?
Well, this is one of the fascinating things about Bill Fulton, and something that I think people don't perhaps still even appreciate, because most people that work with the FBI do so because they've committed a crime, they're trying to reduce a sentence, they're sort of forced to,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
So you get into the criminal informant, and then that brings into question all the things that they're saying. Are they manufacturing evidence simply to reduce a sentence or to get out of going to jail? And it becomes this sort of shady, questionable thing. But Bill got involved with the FBI because someone came into his store with a plan to attack a military recruiting station, like blow it up.
Right.
And Bill, who had been taken into confidence by this guy who assumed that Bill must feel the same way he did, and of course he did not, was appalled by this and had to really make this pivotal choice in his life. Do I go to the FBI or do I not? And most people would say, well, of course you go to the FBI. But connection with the FBI was really a death sentence for his business, for his way of life,
sure,
for the employment of all these people, because the customer base was very anti-government. And if it ever came out that he was associated with the FBI in any way, that was really the death knell for all of that he had worked so hard for. So it really was a little bit of a moral dilemma, because if the guy was just blowing smoke, is this worth giving up your whole life for?
Right.
But if he's not, but if it's not, how can you live with yourself?
Right. And especially this is a guy who helps out veterans, and someone comes to him with plans for blowing up a recruiting center.
Right.
Yeah. So he sort of unwittingly becomes their informant.
Right, because he goes to the FBI, and they're like, well, do you know this guy? Do you know that guy? And he's like, yeah, I know them all. They all shop in my store. So the FBI went, holy smokes, this guy's a treasure trove of information. And, and the rest is kind of history, and there's a bunch of fun, stories about it. But that's eventually how he gets led down the trail to Schaefer Cox.
And Schaefer Cox, he's the weasel you can imagine. I mean, he's the perfectly written character that I said that can't be his real name. He doesn't. He even sounds so creepy and so made up. And here he is running this sovereign citizens militia group, right?
Right. And the funny thing about Schaefer Cox is, and you can Google him online and look at a picture, he's like adorable. He looks like, he was in his early 20s, mid-20s at this time, and he wore this little tweed cap. He looks like a paperboy. He looks like a newsie from like the 1920s. You would never in a million bazillion years go, oh, that guy's a domestic terrorist. And he's well-spoken. He has the gift of gab. His dad was a minister, and he kind of picked up that style. So, you listen to him. There are videos all over YouTube of conventions and stuff that he went to and talked. And you can completely understand. He's quite compelling. And these are the people that are the problem. If he came across as this, like, evil, weird, crazy dude, who's going to listen to him? But he came across as this sort of sweet, almost scholarly young student of history who was going to change the system. And he was getting a genuine group of followers simply because of his physical persona and his method of delivery. And, nobody likes paying taxes. Everybody sort of grumbles about various aspects of the government at one point or another. And he was really able to tap into that and get people fired up about it.
There was a whole sovereign citizens group that the whole Oregon standoff, right? That was a group of sovereign citizens, wasn't it?
Well, it's difficult to try to pigeonhole because the whole sort of, and I even hate to use the term patriot movement because it doesn't really encompass anything. It's like a big crazy Venn diagram. There are militia groups that are really scary. There are militia groups that are not scary at all. I've reported on several militias in Alaska that made me feel like, okay, I'm kind of glad these guys are around, in case of fire and flood and earthquake and whatever. But then you have militias on the southern border that are, shooting people that cross illegally. It is such a wide spectrum of beliefs that it's hard to pigeonhole. But there were definitely some sovereign citizens that were at the Bundy Ranch and then also in Oregon at the wildlife refuge.
So is this more widespread in Alaska because Alaska is so spread out because there's the population is so, what's the opposite of dense? So sparse?
Sparse? Alaska's funny because it draws to it a certain breed of person who enjoys fending for themselves, being independent, heading out into the wilderness and building your own cabin, and even those on the left share kind of a libertarian streak with those on the right. So Democrats in Alaska are carrying guns and going hunting and they sort of, if you just read their bullet list, pardon the pun, you'd say this is not a Democrat, this is a Republican. But Alaska sort of leans in a certain way libertarian where there's a lot of, there's just a lot of overlap there. So there is really a sentiment of federal overreach, federal intrusion. And, in Alaska's defense, there's a lot of things up here that really are nothing like in the lower 48.
Like what?
You know, you have schools that are hundreds of miles apart. So when you have a federal regulation that says, well, if this school is failing, just send them to the next school.
Right.
Well, that requires like an airplane. So we tend to feel up here that we're misunderstood, you know, and that the federal government can be out of touch with reality here.
So how is Alaska leaning more? We're speaking with Jeannie Devin. She's the co-author of The Blood of Patriots, a wonderful new book that, again, reads like a novel. And again, not something that if I didn't know you and hadn't read, you know, Jason Leopold's blurb at the back, calling it one hell of a read, that I might not have ever picked up, because it's how I took down an anti-government militia with beer, bounty hunting, and badassery. And by the way, the bounty hunting scenes, some of those are hysterical. This is one of the things that Bill Fulton did in his shop, The Drop Zone. It was a military surplus store, but they also were bounty hunters.
Yes, and that to me, I mean, I was rolling on the couch talking to Bill on the phone when he's telling me some of these stories, and I thought, these are, the truth is crazier than fiction, because you could not make some of this stuff up. And part of the appeal, I guess, of the bounty hunting, which sounds, again, sort of, you know, big and scary, was the fact that these guys, these vets that he was already employing in his store to work retail, to do some security gigs and bars and concerts and that kind of thing, when they moved to bounty hunting, or fugitive recovery, as it is called, they had guns back in hands. They were doing, there was a bad guy that they were responsible to get off the street.
Right.
That sheepdog mentality of protect the innocent, get the bad guys gone, sort of went right to the soul of these guys who were feeling so displaced and like they didn't have purpose.
Right.
No, you know.
Again, the character development is wonderful. And the thing is, it would be one thing if this were a novel, but these are real people. It sounds like a great movie. You know, I could see this being...
Well, actually, funny you should mention, but we just a couple weeks ago signed on with a TV production company put a pilot into the works to turn it into a TV series, which I am incredibly excited about.
That's very exciting.
Yeah, but I think that it's an opportunity to really bring some of these questions to the forefront that don't tend to get talked about a lot in the entertainment world. You know, we have war movies that are shoot 'em ups, and but we don't really have a sustained way of being in touch with characters who are fighting these internal battles and who despite the fracturing of our political nature in this country, were a very cohesive unit. You know, there were Republicans and Democrats, there were different ethnicities, religious beliefs, but these guys had each other's back, regardless.
Right. And they're veterans who've come through fighting in the Middle East and come back with
so
all
I
different...
Think it's a message that, you know, there's hope in a small way, that people are more than their political opinions.
Right. But
that
then
we can...
Yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, but then you also have, you know, the bigger picture of what might be the greater danger or the biggest danger in the country now, which are these militia groups. I know you said some of them are helpful and good, but some of them are really downright scary. And these sovereign citizens groups, in fact, the part that I'm up to now, in the book, Schaefer Cox is trying to buy, they were trying to buy all these grenades and weapons. They want to blow up, I don't know, IRS agents or something. I mean, these are dangerous people. Domestic terrorism is a really scary threat.
Right. It really is. And that's, you know, that's where the title kind of came from, because it comes from the quote by Thomas Jefferson that the tree of liberty must be watered from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants. Mm-hmm. And that was also the slogan that was on Timothy McVeigh's T-shirt when he blew up the federal building in Oklahoma City in the 90s. And it is sort of this rallying cry for the next revolution and for the taking down the government. And yet these people are calling themselves patriots.
Right. And they think they are.
The fact that one of the antagonists in the book is going to blow up a military recruiting station. It's like, you know, what is your definition of patriotism, you know, compared to these people who, you know, whether you agree or disagree with the conflicts that they're in, these people have pledged their lives to that the government will make a good decision and that they will follow. You know, they are soldiers, they are warriors, and they are putting their lives on the line for their government, for their country. And so what do we call patriots? How do we, you know, and how does the left sort of reclaim this title back?
Right.
Because there are many very patriotic people on the left, but they feel weird using the word. And if they do, you know, they've been called unpatriotic by the right for so long now that the word has become toxic almost, which is really a shame.
Well, it is a shame. And especially it's these people who believe that there's no use. They have no use for government. They are sovereign citizens, after all. And they're the ones calling themselves patriots. It's almost,
right.
You know, an oxymoron.
It's very 1984.
Yes, yes.
very Orwellian.
So what are the politics like now in Alaska? I mean, the last time you and I spoke, it's been a long time, Jeannie. And,
right.
You know, Joe Miller, who makes a few appearances in the book, he had won the primary. And then Lisa Murkowski for the U.S. Senate, Lisa Murkowski came out and won the election in a write-in campaign. And she became our hero. When she was one of three votes against the repeal and replace of the Affordable Care Act. So
right. And in addition to that, so we have one sort of standard Republican senator, Dan Sullivan. We have one, and it's funny because Alaska woman maverick in politics, you don't tend to think Lisa Murkowski, but she has actually turned up.
Yes.
Turned up at the party doing what Sarah Palin always claimed to do, to kind of to buck her party, to do what was best for the state. And I still disagree with Lisa Murkowski on a lot of things, but she showed some chutzpah and in the whole healthcare vote. So we have her, and then our governor ran as an independent and won.
Wow.
So I think we have the only independent governor in the nation, and it kind of goes to show that Alaska politics are not necessarily as predictable as you might think them to be. And so now Bill Walker is our current governor, and he will be running again next year as an independent, and he will have many Republican challengers. And he may also have a Democratic challenger because, of course, if you're in the middle, you're going to offend everybody at some point.
Right.
So he has detractors on both sides and fans on both sides, and it's all very complicated.
And what about our old friend Sarah Palin? What has become of her?
You know, I am so happy to be able to tell you that I have no idea.
She just sort
and
of
it's funny, you mentioned
off.
Shannon Moore before, and she and I talk all the time, and you know, we go, God, we had Palin fatigue before anybody even knew who she was.
That's right.
So she has, I don't know, I think she's still on Facebook.
Wow.
But, you know, as far as having any relevance in Alaska politics at all, she has zero.
That's amazing. I know she makes a couple of small appearances in the book as well. At one point, I remember, you know, hearing that Todd was a member of a secessionist group that I guess is pretty
yes.
common up there. That when it made the news, it was like, oh, but that's a common thing.
Right. Well, I wouldn't call it common, but it isn't, you know, gasp worthy, I guess. The Alaska Independence Party has been around for a long time, and they're the sort of, you know, stalwart, mostly old-time Alaskans who say, you know, we could be our own country. We don't need the rest of the
right.
country. And there was a technicality where Alaska actually never did take the vote as to whether to remain a territory, to become a state, or to become an independent sovereign nation.
Mm-hmm.
So they cling to this little, that vote was never actually technically taken. And of course it would have gone for statehood by a wide margin by all indications. And when Alaska became a state, it was a tremendous celebration and huge bonfire and festivities and all this. It was not a controversial thing.
Right.
But these people still remain.
Well, Jeannie Devon.
And Todd Palin was a member for seven years
my goodness.
before Sarah decided to run, and then he switched.
Of course he did. Jeannie Devon.
And she said that he accidentally thought that that was just being an independent, and he didn't realize.
I see.
We're all right.
All right. Well, the book is The Blood of Patriots, How I Took Down an Anti-Government Militia with Beer, Bounty Hunting, and Badassery by Bill Fulton and Jeannie Devon. Jeannie, it's great talking with you again. Thank you so much.
It was a pleasure.
Send my regards to Shannon Moore as well, please.
I certainly will, and thanks for having me on. It was great fun.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right. Have a great weekend, everyone.